From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. With apologies to Tim Kirkjian, the Yankees are still the Yankees, but will they still be the Yankees even after the celebration of their 27th World Series championship has given way to off-season roster reshuffling? That story is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, a conversation with ESPN's Bill Simmons about his new stat-laden tome titled The Book of Basketball. Also ahead, a no-nonsense Alabama builds a winning football program at Duke.
The mission of the university and the mission of the football program can go hand in hand. Our guys are busy, busy, busy academically. They write more papers in a semester than I wrote my entire academic career.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Friday, New Yorkers turned out in large and happy numbers to celebrate the most recent World Series triumph of the Yankees. The older members of the adoring crowd have had lots of practice at this. The Yankees have been champions 27 times. Shortstop and captain Derek Jeter has been a member of five of those championship teams. During yesterday's celebration, which was broadcast on WCBS Radio in New York, he thanked Yankees fans for their support.
I know when we closed the old stadium, I talked about the fans. You've taken the memories from one stadium to the next. You guys definitely did not disappoint us. So this here is for the fans, and especially for the boss who's back home and the entire Steinbrenner family. Thank you.
Hideki Matsui was named World Series MVP, in large part certainly for his six runs batted in Wednesday night when the Yankees beat the Phils 7-3 to seal the deal. But it can be argued that the heart of this team consists of Jeter, Jorge Posada, Andy Pettit, and Mariano Rivera, who have come to know each other exceptionally well.
They were together in 1992 on the low A team in Greensboro. So the fact that they're all still together all these years later is amazing. The fact that they're still elite players is amazing.
Joel Sherman covers the Yankees for the New York Post.
I've learned kind of not to bet against them, but there always has to be a worry moving forward that you keep investing in guys that one day hit the wall in the long marathon that is their career.
In that regard, Mariano Rivera, who at 39 is perhaps the most dependable closer in the game, announced this week that he'd like to play five more years. Maybe he will. Maybe they all will. If so, Joel Sherman thinks those years will be spent in New York.
These players also want to be known as players who spent their whole career as Yankees. They don't really want to go anyplace else. Derek Jeter as a Milwaukee Brewer or Mariano Rivera as a Los Angeles Angel doesn't really sound quite as good in their legacy as going soup to nuts as a Yankee. So somehow I always think that both sides will find a way to keep it going.
The same may not be true of Matsui, who's had operations on both his knees, or Johnny Damon either, despite his heroics on the base paths during the series. The Yankees will decide whether to try to re-sign both players during the offseason. Some observers have already begun to consider larger issues. In his latest article for New York Magazine, Will Leach writes, "It's time to get down to business. It wouldn't be the Yankees if we let one little championship distract us from the real goal, total global domination." And joining me now from New York is Will Leach. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Will, the Yankees are one of the few sports franchises that view 9 years between titles as an extended drought. How did the team and its fans manage to keep up a collective brave face since the Bronx Bombers' last championship way back in 2000?
You know, it's amazing. I don't know how they went through it. It's been difficult for a lot of people. And yes, it's been 9 years, and every other franchise would say, oh, I'm so sorry. But hey, you know, think out there somewhere. There is an 8-year-old child who is his first Yankees World Series.
Daddy, Daddy, they won!
I've waited so long!
Designated hitter Hideki Matsui's contract is up. He's 35. He is not really able to play the field anymore after two knee operations. Some people might think that it would be hard for the Yankees to let the World Series MVP go, but as you point out, that is something that's worked before.
Yes, the MVP in the 1996 series was John Wetland. who was their closer, and he was very dominant, and he was about to be a free agent, and the Yankees had a guy, I struggled to remember his name in the eighth inning, it was Mariano something, yeah, Mariano Rivera, actually. So I think they're probably going to do that again this year. You know, it's not so much, you know, dissatisfaction with Matsui. This team actually is aging, like, quite a bit. You know, they're going to need more time to rest some of those regular guys like Jorge Posada and Alex Rodriguez, and if they re-sign Johnny Damon, they'll need Johnny Damon. A way to rest those guys is to play them as the DH.
Hard-throwing pitcher Jabba Chamberlain gets a lot of attention, but he has yet to live up to the high expectations the franchise has had for him. How will they use the sometimes starter, sometimes reliever next season?
The yearly fight over what to do with Jabba Chamberlain is, it's becoming as much of a tradition as, well, as winning World Series used to be, I suppose, with the Yankees. You know, the debate over Jabba actually has a lot of the Moneyball debate to it, and a lot of the sabermetrics debate to it, and the idea that if you have a pitcher of Jabba's quality, you want him to throw as many innings as possible. You use him as a starter. I think they're still going to go ahead and try to have him start next year. I think young hard-throwing pitchers like Jabba are the most valuable commodity in baseball. And you don't want to just waste those guys by tossing them in the seventh or eighth inning of games.
A lot of people are saying that Alex Rodriguez's postseason performance, which was extraordinary, has erased memories of previous fall flops. But I'm willing to bet that the boos would return pretty quickly if he was hitting 250 at the end of May. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. He's had such a crazy year. I think one of the best moves he made this year was to generally understand that he's never going to be Jeter. I think he's actually a better player than Jeter, but he's never going to be beloved among Yankee fans the way that Jeter is. And I think that weird kind of competition existed for a while. It's extremely unlikely that Alex Rodriguez is going to be hitting 250 at the end of May because he is an outstanding baseball player. So to me, what it really does is it allows him to finally just be quietly great, like he has been for his entire career. There will be fewer eyebrows raised every time he strikes out, which occasionally does happen even to the best players.
All right, Will, the Yankees have their 27th title, and they would seem to be in good shape for another run next year. So, to use your language, just how close to world domination are they?
Well, I've noticed their names showing up on the top of my utility bills, but I don't know if that may be something different. I think that they certainly have to be considered the favorites to win again next year. You know, the Yankees management, yes, they do have more money than everyone else. They do spend more money than everyone else, but they're also not dumb. They've got a backup plan on this. And one of the great things about being the Yankees, if you make a mistake, you can just write a check and fix it. Most baseball teams don't get a chance to do that. They're not going away, I'm afraid.
Will Leach writes for New York Magazine. You can find a link to his article titled 2009 is Already Old News, What's Next for the Yankees? On our website, onlyagame.org. Will, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Of course. Thank you for your time, sir.
Duke University is well known for Coach K, Final Fours, and a fierce basketball rivalry with North Carolina. But Duke's football team is rarely in the news, unless it's setting a record for futility. The Blue Devils are the only team in college football history to post two streaks of 20 or more consecutive losses, both of which occurred in the last decade. But that might be changing. Duke is 5-3 this season. With a win today against North Carolina, the Blue Devils would be just one game away from bowl eligibility. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio has the story.
It's a cool, wet Carolina morning, and the sun is streaking through the loblolly pines that ring Duke's practice field. It's a soothing, even serene setting, but not for long.
That's horse. You look afraid. Gonna be in there with the number one unit. Pop his ass, Kenny. And nobody's stopping you but you.
David Cutcliffe is a football coach. He started as the student assistant coach with the University of Alabama's Bear Bryant, and he coached Peyton and Eli Manning in college. He's a self-professed good old boy, an old school motivator who doesn't miss a thing from his perch atop a 40-foot tall tower.
That's what I want to see, Danny. That was better right there with that wedge on the fives. That boy, Danny Parker.
Cutcliffe is the latest in a long line of men who have tried to resurrect Duke football. a school that has produced as many Nobel laureates as bowl game victories.
Being from Alabama, I don't think anybody around here sounds like me, but, you know, I've loved it. I like being surrounded by exceptional people. The mission of the university and the mission of the football program can go hand in hand. We know we're going to win at Duke, and that's what's so exciting about this.
But winning football is not exactly in Duke's DNA. Excuses for losing have surrounded the program for decades. Academics are too tough. The admissions office doesn't help out. The facilities are too small. But at the top of the list is a culture of losing that has permeated the program for decades. Barry Jacobs is a journalist, author, and historian who has followed Duke football since arriving on campus as a student in the 1960s.
When I first got to Duke, it reminded me of the old New York Mets because they always found a way to lose. It was entertaining, whether it was the snap on the extra point that would have won the game or watching the other team go 90 yards on the next to last play when it seemed like it was all over. And so I think that over the years you build an expectation of failure.
The biggest difference this season has been that those plays have gone the other way. Last Saturday, in Duke's back-and-forth game against Virginia, the Cavaliers owned a 17-12 lead with less than 4 minutes remaining. This is where Duke has always folded, on the road in a hostile stadium. Except this time, they didn't.
Single receiver right, slot right, two receivers left. From the shotgun, Lewis, here comes the blitz. Lewis looks, guns it down the middle, caught on the run by Connor Vernon, in the open, touchdown!
Bob Harris of the Blue Devil ISP Sports Network has made more of those calls this year than ever, and most have involved Thaddeus Lewis, the senior quarterback who earlier this season threw for more than 500 yards against NC State. Lewis started as a freshman in 2006 when Duke lost all 12 of its games. He says the biggest change has been confidence.
When somebody scoring us my freshman year, honest to God, you know, a lot of people put their head down and things like that. Now it's just like the offense, like, okay, let's go out here and respond. You know, they scored on us, let's go back and respond back and we score.
The attitude may be changing, but it takes real bricks and mortar to build a major college program these days. It will cost hundreds of millions of dollars to renovate Duke's Wallace Wade Stadium and build an indoor practice facility. But for the first time, the university seems to be going all in financially, evidenced by Cutcliffe's competitive $1.7 million salary. Cutcliffe's job is a tough one. Find and recruit talented players who can do the academic work.
This is a world-class academic institution. Our guys are busy, busy, busy academically. They write more papers in a semester than I wrote my entire academic career.
Cutcliffe wasn't hired to critique Joyce or analyze statistical models, even if his players do. He was hired to win football games. And if he and the Blue Devils can do that today against traditional basketball arch-nemesis North Carolina and one more time in their remaining three games, they'll be on their way to a bowl game for just the third time in almost 50 years. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
That's how you practice to win. You gotta practice to win. You gotta bring your feet on contact, red shirt.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Paolo Torina of Cernusco Lombardone will probably not deny that he enjoys riding his motorcycle at high speeds over Italy's highways. However, it would seem that Mr. Torina has a legitimate complaint regarding the loss of his license pursuant to a speeding ticket he recently received. The authorities claim that their radar gun clocked Mr. Torina at 383 miles per hour. What did they think they were clocking, a jet fighter? Mr. Torina asked. If I could go that fast, I would enter my bike in the MotoGP World Championships. Valentino Rossi would not stand a chance. Police officials blamed, quote, botched paperwork for the 383-mile-per-hour charge. Multiple MotoGP champion Valentino Rossi had no comment. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, remembering Sheboygan, Wisconsin's NBA franchise on the 50th anniversary of its one and only season in the league. But first, here to discuss the 2009-2010 NBA season is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Bill.
The Orlando Magic made the finals last spring, and some felt that one or two good offseason moves would put the team in a much better position to win it all this year. Did they make the right moves?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I believe they did. I think Vince Carter was an excellent pickup, and I think that team is one of four teams in the NBA who could win the championship this year.
Shaquille O'Neal now with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and it would seem in the early going that the vaunted pairing of Shaq and LeBron hasn't quite gelled yet. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think Shaq's actually playing at the peak of his diminished capacity, and it's definitely not working. The Cavaliers are like a car that had a broken fuel pump and got a new stereo. The last thing I feel like they needed was a big lane-clogging guy who can't pull his man away from the basket. Ironically, what they would have done better, I think, acquiring is a guy named Rasheed Wallace, who stretches the floor, can shoot the three. I mean, Shaq just clogs up that lane, and that lane belongs to LeBron late in games.
Well, just to push your metaphor a little further, any possibility that Cleveland acquires a fuel pump between now and, oh, say, midseason?
It looks like they're going to have to do something. Poor Cleveland fans, every team is looking in these early games like, how are we going to do this year? Are we going to make the finals? Or can we contend? But Cleveland has a bigger problem. They need to not only contend, but they need to create an environment that is desirable to keep LeBron James in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
So with every one of these losses, and they've already lost more games at home this year than they did all of last year, not only do the possibility of home court advantage in the playoffs start to slip away, but I think they can feel LeBron James slipping away. So if they have an opportunity to do something via trade, they have to do everything they can to try to create that environment, because he looks unhappy already.
In the West, the Nuggets and Suns have gotten off to good starts. Is it too early to speculate that one of these teams could challenge the Lakers when it really counts?
It's too early. It's inappropriate. It won't happen. The Nuggets and Suns are mirages. They will not beat the Lakers. No one in the West is going to beat the Lakers in the playoffs. No one's going to beat the Lakers 4 out of 7 games. The Lakers have reloaded. They look great. I mean, Pau Gasol's not even playing yet. And that team they look perfectly orchestrated for a repeat run. Not to tip my hand as to my prediction.
Right. Well, let me just offer some hope to people who don't want to see the Lakers repeat. Though he denied it all of last season, one of Kobe Bryant's goals was to win a championship without the assistance of Shaquille O'Neal. He did it. Of course, the Lakers are defending champs. So is Bryant now any less motivated?
He doesn't look it. Looks like he's moved into that kind of Jordan phase of he's motivated on every possession. He's motivated to play defense. He's motivated to get his teammates involved. Artest is a defensive stopper, and Bynum is playing very well, averaging 20 points and 9 rebounds a game in the early going. I mean, this is a champion that basically added Andrew Bynum and Ron Artest and still has the best crunch time player in the game. So, I'd love to be able to extend hope to all those Spurs fans and Nuggets fans and Blazers fans and Jazz fans, but there isn't any.
So early in the season to be so definitive.
Well, they can root for injury, I guess. That's the Hail Mary.
Well, as you say, the Lakers picked up Ron Artest in the offseason. The Celtics countered with the aforementioned Rasheed Wallace. Are we looking at another case of immovable basketball object meets unstoppable basketball object?
Well, the Celtics certainly seem a little more fragile than some of the other contenders in terms of being a little long in the tooth and Kevin Garnett coming back from the knee injury. But if the Celtics are healthy come May and June, they will make it to the finals against the Lakers. And it will sort of be the rubber match, 08, 09, and 2010, best 2 out of 3 between the Celtics and the Lakers. And I think David Stern could live with that.
Are there other teams that we should be speaking about that are noteworthy for some reason other than the fact of being contenders?
Well, it's funny. I thought, it's always good to have a sleeper or two. And I was like, I don't want to be dishonest. I don't want to say this team has a chance when I don't believe they have a chance. So truthfully, I believe the four teams that could win the NBA championship this year are the Los Angeles Lakers in the West, and then the Magic, the Cavaliers, and the Celtics in the East. However, I have a soft spot for the San Antonio Spurs, and this does seem like the last roundup. And if I was forced to come up with a sleeper, a sleeping sleeper, I would say that Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, and Tony Parker, having had Antonio McDyess and Richard Jefferson and rookie DeJuan Blair added to the mix, maybe as they go into the sunset, could pull off one more ride.
Manu Ginobili caught a bat in his bare hands and rid the arena of it. This has to be an omen for something good, doesn't it?
he's added a new category to the stat pack. I love Manu, but as he pointed out sheepishly, he said, when you can't dunk anymore, you need to do something extraordinary to make the news, you know, to make the highlights. And I think within that funny, self-deprecating phrase is the problem with the Spurs. Manu can't jump anymore. Duncan was seriously outplayed by Carlos Boozer Thursday night in Utah, and they just look like an old team.
Finally, Kevin, your buddy Bill Simmons will join us in about 20 minutes to talk about his new book about basketball stats and opinions. Do you have a message for him?
Well, I have a message for basketball fans. Buy Bill's book. I've read it. It's just an outstanding collection of argument starters and essays, chock-a-block full of information, the history of the game, and, of course, Bill's top 96 players of all time. I just highly recommend it.
Kevin Hench is a columnist for FoxSports.com, and he joins me from time to time to talk about the NBA. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
In 1949, a merger between the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America created the 17-team National Basketball Association. Big town teams like the Boston Celtics, the New York Knicks, Minneapolis Lakers, and Detroit Pistons shared the floor with teams like the Waterloo Hawks, the Anderson Duffy Packers, and the Sheboygan Redskins. Producer David Maxson remembers the NBA's short-lived Sheboygan franchise.
So this is your whole archive, huh?
You know
that. How long have you been compiling that?
Since the late 60s.
Bill Himmelman spent 17 years between 1985 and 1982 as the official NBA historian. His New Jersey basement is filled with decades of carefully compiled pro basketball records. Near a humming dehumidifier and an electric typewriter is a card catalog, yellow with age, that Himmelman says contains records of every single player, coach, and referee in NBA history.
The Sheboygan Redskins were kind of a counterpart to the Green Bay Packers in football. There was a whole lot of community pride in the team, very community-owned, and all the ownership were Sheboygan people.
This summer, I tracked down one of the last remaining players from Sheboygan's NBA days at his home in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Hi, Howdy, Dave. You Milt?
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead in to the right.
Sure.
Milt Schoon spent 2 years with Sheboygan, from 1948 to 1950.
I was playing at Flint, and my contract was up, and it was sold to Sheboygan, and my wife and I went over there and looked at the town. It was a small town, and I kind of wondered how in the devil they could, you know, support a team.
But supported they did. The Sheboygan Redskins played in the Sheboygan Armory, a 3,500-seat arena that was built as a WPA project during the Depression. NBA coaching legend Red Auerbach got a dose of Sheboygan loyalty when he came to town as coach of the Tri-City Blackhawks in 1950. He claims the fans would throw paperclips at him, and that once, a local cop refereed a Redskins-Blackhawks game as a last-minute substitution. When Auerbach got upset with the call, the ref threatened to eject him and lock him up where no one would ever find him. Milt Schoon claims Auerbach misremembers the incident.
That's what they claim, he was a local cop, but he wasn't. But he did have a local cop and visit him in the middle of about the third quarter. He got a little rambunctious in that town. And that town would back their players 100%. And, boy, they really got on him. And so they told him to leave, and the old boy come in and grabbed him by the arm, and out they went.
The police.
Yep. It was all right.
Red Auerbach said that the fans would be throwing
paper clips at him. You know anything about that?
Well, Red would have been better off if he would have sat on the bench and coached instead of trying to get out and put on a show, because the people there just didn't take to it. If he thought that he was going to be king, they proved that he wasn't going to be.
Auerbach was only ejected that night, not locked up. But they tried to kick him out of the building altogether. But Auerbach says it was bitter cold outside, so they let him stay, but he was banned from the locker room and forced to sit in the stands with the hostile Sheboygan crowd for the rest of the game.
I would go up to most of the home games and the practices because I lived only two blocks away from the armory.
73-year-old Bob Wetstein, who still lives in Sheboygan, remembers hanging out at Redskins practices as a kid and paying 40 cents admission to the games when he had the money.
But otherwise, I'd take a screwdriver and I'd pry the door open. And sometimes the janitor would leave us in, too, because he felt sorry for us.
Bob says that despite its relatively small size, Sheboygan didn't let the big city teams intimidate them.
The New York Knicks were coming to town, and they had a big spread in the paper. Yeah, we got to go to this town that was all the yards a whistle stop. Well, when they left, they went with their tails behind their legs. The place that they played, the Armory, only held about 3,600. And then when those teams would come, they'd cram 42 into it.
Despite the enthusiastic support, running a team was often difficult in those early NBA days. Milt Schoon says players had to help out the best they could.
We traveled in two great big Suburbans. We played a ball game in Chicago, and we had to drive these two Suburbans after the game back to Sheboygan. And it was snowing like all get out. And finally, I had to get on the hood of that thing and keep the windshield clean so the driver could see where he was going. And everybody thought I was nuts, but somebody had to do it. I'd rather do that than hit somebody head on.
The Redskins were good enough to make the playoffs in their one NBA season, losing a close three-game series in the Western Conference semifinals to the Indianapolis Olympians. They had a decent team, but in the end, money became the overriding issue for the Redskins. Again, historian Bill Himmelman.
The large market owners wanted big venues. They wanted large seating capacity. And they didn't see that happening at those smaller towns.
The Redskins stuck around for one more year in the newly formed National Professional Basketball League. But the excitement waned and attendance dropped. The NPBL folded and the Redskins were history.
In New York and Chicago and Detroit, they all had the big field and a big drawing power. So you could see the writing on the wall that it's going to be a big town team and the smaller ones are go out. And that's the way it went.
The Armory is still standing in Sheboygan. No one plays basketball in it anymore, but the impact of that first NBA season still reverberates 60 years later. Milt Schoon is wistful about those days.
When we played, it was a team. It was five guys. Everybody's working with each other, and now it's just run and shoot. No defense, just go, go, go. But for me, give me the old-fashioned game. It was a lot better.
For his part, Bill Himmelman thinks the NBA and its fans owe Sheboygan, Wisconsin, at least a small debt of gratitude.
It put the league on the map, so to speak. I think it brought its attention to the sporting public and put it on a par with baseball and football.
These days, there's talk of building a spaceport in Sheboygan for commercial rockets. The project, backed by Lockheed Martin and the Johnsonville Bratwurst Company, would turn the Armory into a space education center. That seems fitting, as if somehow the city is trying to reignite its own enthusiasm for things that launch into the stratosphere. For Only a Game, I'm David Maxson.
You're listening to Only a Game. For last week's program, Only a Game associate producer Karen Given traveled to Wellfleet on Cape Cod and got oyster liquor splashed all over her. So to call her intrepid would be not only a cliche, but an understatement, wouldn't it? Anyway, the resulting story about the annual oyster shucking competition in Wellfleet so inspired several of our listeners that they felt compelled to share their experiences with Karen by posting their comments under her story as it appeared on our website, onlyagame.org. "The competition is amazing and the food is great. Slurp 'em down," wrote a listener named Kate. "I wish they had a camera so we could see the oysters." Actually, Kate and you can see the oysters because Karen did have a camera. Check her photos out on our website. Of the same event, Marge and Dave wrote, "The crowd was huge and we had trouble making it up front to watch the shuck off. We came all the way from Buffalo for it and the long drive was worth it. We each slurped a few dozen of the finest tasting oysters we have ever had." Patrick McGuire's similarly enthusiastic celebration of the shuck off ends, "Congratulations to Chopper, who was the guy who took home the $1,000 first prize for prompt and prodigious shucking." We also heard from Dave Roberts, who helped Ed Viesters write K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain. I spoke with Ed about the book a couple of weeks ago, and although his writing partner wrote that he thinks Only a Game is, quote, always lively, funny, and fresh, he asked, "Did you read the book or just skim it?" I read it, or at least most of it. I mean, I hit all the peaks, may have skipped some of the valleys. Also on the book front, we heard this week from Jean Evans, "I appreciate the reviews of sports books." She wrote, "In my work as an outreach librarian, I select books for homebound individuals. Your reviews are my best source for information on sports books. I'd be lost without the radio program and the online reviews. Thank you, and keep the reviews coming." You can check out said reviews at our website, onlyagame.org, and if it seems to you I've only skimmed one or more of those books, you can register your objection there. You can also respond to anything you've heard on the program by calling our listener line, 617-353-1860, or you can send us a postcard or a letter at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A $100 fee may seem a little stiff for participation in a 3.5-mile race, but not if the fee includes a gorilla suit. 1,061 people paid that fee and wore those suits in Denver on Halloween, thus breaking the Guinness World Record for number of people gathered in gorilla suits, running or not. The annual race raises money for the Mountain Gorilla Conservation Fund and also keeps in business a costume company specializing in gorilla suits. I made that last part up, but it's probably true, don't you think? Every time I look at you, I go, hey, can you drop it, hey? You're a big gorilla. You drop it, hey, hey. I want to kill you. But I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Bill Simmons builds a pyramid in his book of basketball. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since we last spoke, Major League Baseball has crowned a new champion. Wow, New Yorkers must be excited that their Yankees have finally won the World Series.
Yes, they're marching down the Canyon of Heroes, probably on giant mobile dollar signs.
I guess the Yankees radio network didn't have any doubt that New York would, in fact, win the World Series.
Yeah, WCBS ran a commercial from a sporting goods store prior to Game 6 saying, "Congratulations on your 27th championship."
Charlie, as if losing to the Phillies in the National League Championship Series wasn't bad enough, the Dodgers learned this week that pitcher Vicente Padilla was shot in the leg. However, he did not shoot himself in the leg in a nightclub in New York with a gun that he was carrying illegally, so Mr. Padilla has that going for him.
That's right. Somewhere in a cell somewhere, Plaxico Burress is thinking, darn, why didn't I think of this? Yeah, he was at a shooting range. And apparently he was having trouble clearing his gun, so he handed it to a bodyguard who said, I can do it, Chief. Up, clear. There's no bullet in here.
We shouldn't laugh.
Well, there's one in my leg, dummy.
This week, Dan Snyder, the owner of Washington's pro football team, issued an apology. Was he at long last apologizing for the team's name?
No, not at all. He's just saying they're playing really badly and they're letting everyone down. He does not, of course, indicate whether or not he thinks his stewardship of this team has let anyone down, but apparently everyone else has.
The Oakland Raiders, who have had six different head coaches since 2001, may be about to get their seventh. What's the likelihood that current head coach Tom Cable lasts through this season?
I think he will last through this season. I think the odds that he is the coach of the Raiders 13 seconds after the season ends are probably pretty slim. The accusations of domestic abuse seem to be really taking hold out there. He's already in court having allegedly punched one of his assistant coaches. His team stinks. I'm not entirely sure what order you're going to put these things in when he loses his job, but the Oakland Raiders right now are the biggest mess in the NFL.
How often does this happen, Charlie? Florida coach Urban Meyer suspended linebacker Brandon Spikes for half of the team's game against Vanderbilt. The offense was trying to gouge out the eye of a Georgia player last week, and that's not even the weirdest part of the story. You want to pick it up from there?
Well, he was suspended by his coach for half the entire Vanderbilt game. He has determined that he will sit out the entire Vanderbilt game because he doesn't want to be, quote, a distraction to the team. University of Florida sports information spokesman, the Easter Bunny, was heard to say, isn't this a really good plan and isn't it a nice story and do you all believe this now?
And who wants an egg?
Exactly. And would you like an egg now?
Lots of basketball fans know that Manu Ginobili of the San Antonio Spurs has quick hands. No surprise there. And he demonstrated those quick hands on Halloween night to thunderous applause, although I understand maybe he wishes he hadn't done that.
Yeah, apparently he had to go through the grueling regimen of rabies shots, having grabbed a bat out of midair that was plaguing his ball club. There's no precedent I can reach back to in time for this, but I do think his coach is right that when it's time to handle animals of the less than two-legged variety, it's a job for professionals.
The college basketball season hasn't even started yet, but if you had high hopes for Syracuse this year, it may be time to reevaluate. Do you think when the Orange suited up for an exhibition game against Division II Lemoyne, anybody in their home court thought they would lose?
No, I don't think so, but Lemoyne did beat them 82-79. This is an interesting phenomenon we have here, actually, Bill. Usually, you would schedule the Division II team as a warm-up, as part of your regular schedule, but because of some shenanigans that was surrounding exhibition games against various AAU aggregations whose players suddenly, remarkably, decided to go to school at the school where they played the exhibition games. I'm shocked
to
learn
believe.
That. Now you've got Division II being used in a place where things like Athletes in Action and the Russian junior national team used to be.
Marcus, son of Michael Jordan, wore Air Jordans when his team, University of Central Florida, played St. Leo on Wednesday in another exhibition game. Central Florida won the game, but they lost their contract with Adidas, which did not appreciate young Jordan's independent thinking regarding his footwear. How long before Nike rides in to the rescue?
Well, they better now, or Michael will get upset, and if you're Nike, you don't want to get Michael upset.
Since Union Chief Paul Kelly was fired back in August, things have been a little unsteady. That's the understatement of the week right there at the National Hockey League Players Association. But after the most recent round of resignations / firings, I can't figure out who's in charge there. Can you?
Well, right now, the interim director is gone, the outside counsel is gone, and a six-member advisory board is gone. But luckily, the chief of business affairs is going to run the union temporarily. If he's smart, he won't get a title because that seems to be the kiss of death. And they've brought in a new outside counsel. Of course, if you're NHL management, you're popping champagne at this point.
Okay, here's a straightforward question. On Sunday, did an American finally win the New York City Marathon? I'm inclined to say yes, and so is the winner, Meb Keflezighi. What about you?
Of course he is. I mean, this whole quote-unquote controversy is an example of how to get people arguing about stupid things. the man has been here since he was 12. He's an American citizen. He emerged from an American distance running program, but just because he was born in Eritrea, one of the toughest places in the world, to get to the age of five, we've got idiot sports writers saying, well, he's not really American. Hey, I always thought Martina Navratilova was an American. I mean, why shouldn't we, you know, do what we do in everything and sort of buy the best products from overseas?
I knew that if we lived long enough, we'd learn that a pro golfer had taken performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah, but I didn't think it was going to be this guy.
I didn't either, but the first PGA pro suspended for doping is not a distinction likely to delight Mr. Doug Barron.
But it's the only distinction of his entire PGA career. He's 40 years old. He lost his tour card 3 years ago. He's been suspended for a year. He played 8 seasons on the tour, and his best finish was a tie for third in a tournament in 2006. Some of his fellow players rallied to his defense by saying, look at this guy. What are you, crazy? I don't believe
this. I can beat him.
Exactly.
And finally, Charlie, I guess anybody thinking about bothering Queen Elizabeth and figuring her footman won't be much of an obstacle better think again, right?
Yes, David Hintz, a.k.a. David DeVille, is a heavyweight wrestling champion, and he beat John the Don Ritchie in Thurrock, Essex, to win the British Heavyweight Championship. And I think it would be really terrific if he showed up for work one day in his wrestling togs.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
And we are amused.
Should you wish to navigate the fascinating world of sports radio with opposable thumbs, please do so by visiting onlyagame.org. Bill Simmons, known to more than many as the star of Page 2 on ESPN.com, has written a basketball book. It is called The Book of Basketball, and many people will not be able to lift it without using both hands, and it is more fun than a lot of basketball games, especially mid-season NBA games when everybody just wishes the playoffs could start. The Book of Basketball features pyramids and the secret, and it ranks players and teams, and it contains a story about Michael Jordan in a bar that I'm eventually going to ask Bill Simmons to tell. The author joins me now from KQED in San Francisco. Bill, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Great to be here.
In the chapter titled The Hall of Fame Pyramid, you write, and I'm quoting now, I wish we could blow up the Basketball Hall of Fame and start over. Why is that?
I just think the NBA should have its own Hall of Fame. I think the Hall of Fame that we have right now is trying to do too many things. It's about the history of basketball. It's about college basketball. The other thing that kills me is that the people aren't weighed by importance, and it's actually a lot like how the Hollywood Walk of Fame works, where you'll be walking along Hollywood Boulevard, and you'll see Frank Sinatra, and then you'll see, like, Burt Convy. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Were they equally stars? No, actually, they weren't. And my thing was, like, blow up the Hall of Fame, put it in French Lick, Indiana, the home of basketball, mm-hmm. turn it into an Egyptian pyramid, and do it by levels. And part of the fun would be, is John Stockton, is he a level 3 or a level 4? Is Scottie Pippen a level 2 or is he level 3? And so on and so on. And now you're actually waiting the guys. And then when you go to visit the Hall of Fame, you know, let's say I bring my son in 6 years. He's 8 years old. I'm trying to teach him about the NBA. We go to the Egyptian Pyramid Hall of Fame, and we're going up the levels, and we're going up, and now we're in the Pantheon. And there's Hakeem Olajuwon and Shaq and Michael Jordan and Bird and Magic and Oscar and Jerry. Like, that's what the Hall of Fame should be.
Yeah, but if you're going to bring your son to the Hall of Fame, you'd keep the room where you get to shoot baskets, right? In Springfield, you get to do that.
I would absolutely keep that room. And in fact, that was really the only salvaging grace of the of the Basketball Hall of Fame was shooting baskets. And I think, sadly, people went there to go shoot baskets and not to look at the plaques.
A good deal of the Book of Basketball is devoted to ranking the players whom you consider the greatest ever. And while I was reading your 5-page exploration of the virtues of Dave Cowens, I found myself wondering how many players would have the patience to read about themselves at such length.
That's interesting. You know, I know some of them will. Like, I know Nash a little bit, and I know he'll end up reading the book. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how he feels as I passionately say that he didn't deserve the 2006 MVP. You know, I think for the older guys, maybe somebody like Elgin or Oscar Robertson would appreciate that somebody wrote about all the stuff that they dealt with, which, you know, we always hear about Jack Robinson and we always hear about Larry Doby and all that stuff, and rightfully so. But I think the basketball players in the late 50s and in the 60s arguably dealt with an even bigger identity issue, because in baseball, at least, there was a mix of white players and black players in the 50s and 60s that were carrying the league. In basketball, it was really mostly black guys. You look back at some of the stuff that happened to them, and it's like, yeah, Oscar Robertson's really bitter right now, and he's known as a crank and a curmudgeon, but he had a real reason to be that way. You know, he didn't make a decision to become a curmudgeon. He had a lot of stuff happen to him that shaped the kind of person he was.
The celebration of black players notwithstanding, you seem to regard Bill Walton as the embodiment of what you call the secret, even though he calls it the choice. What are you and he talking about? I mean, assuming you want to give this away to people who haven't actually bought the book yet.
No, I don't mind giving away. You know, the main reason I wrote the book was because it bothers me that we use statistics to evaluate which players are better than others in basketball. There's definitely a place for them, and it's a nice way for us to know that so-and-so had a good game, whatever. But ultimately, it's you can only play five guys at a time, and the teams that win are the teams that win because they meshed together, and they played with one another, and they sacrificed their stats. You know, the whole premise of my book is that there's something called The Secret, which I learned from Isaiah Thomas at a tapas pool in Las Vegas. I won't spoil that part. But it's basically about that the secret to basketball is that it's not about basketball, that it's about all the other factors with how you relate to your teammates and how you make guys better, and you don't care about your own stats. And all you care about is how you fit into the team concept and how you make your teammates better. Walton was one of the guys who understood that fundamentally and totally from when he played in high school through UCLA to Portland. They win the title in 1977, and then he gets hurt. So for me, you know, he's just a tragic figure. And we hear about Mickey Mantle. Oh, man, if Mickey's knee hadn't gone in 1951. I've heard that since I was 2 years old. You never hear anyone talk about Bill Walton. So it's frustrating to me. It's like this guy should have been one of the best 10 players ever, and he's had 45,000 foot surgeries.
Bill, you conclude that the distinction of greatest NBA player belongs to Michael Jordan, and of course a lot of people would agree, but you also say that nobody will ever grab that title from Jordan. What makes you so sure of that?
This is a guy who was homicidally competitive. He had this fundamental need to conquer and to win in everything he did. The rule in the league was not to talk trash to Jordan during the game. Players were instructed, look, don't make eye contact with him. Don't say anything that will get this guy fired up. Hang your head. Pretend you're honored to be with him and just hope he doesn't get mad. Just his force of personality. I tell a story in a book about sitting next to him in 2006 at a hotel room bar, the Four Seasons in Houston. We were in the bar, we were having lunch, and he came and he sat down with Charles Oakley. And we just kind of watched the way his life was for the next 5 hours and the way everyone dealt with him. And it really reminded me of the first scene in The Godfather with Vito Corleone. You know, it was people were in that Luca Brasi mode of, reciting to themselves what they were going to say before they approached The Godfather. He has all these people kowtowing to him and racing around. And then eventually the cards came out and we got to see the real Jordan, not the corporate Jordan, not Mr. Marketability Jordan. We got to see the competitive Jordan, the guy who drops F-bombs and tries to intimidate people and his nonstop chatter. And it kind of all made sense to me. I was like, this is why this guy was the greatest, because even in this stupid little card game in this hotel bar, this guy has to win.
Would it surprise you to learn that some people who've read your book assume that you have serious crushes on a lot of the players in the NBA?
Yeah, I think it's like anything else. I think certain guys resonate with you mm-hmm. a certain way. I mean, for me, Larry Bird, as I write in the prologue, Larry Bird had such a huge impact on me as a basketball fan, because I'm not ashamed to admit it. If I had to do a top 50 greatest moments of my life, probably 11 of them he was involved in. It's embarrassing.
I just have to wonder what your immediate family thinks about something like
that.
Well,
I didn't say he was in the top 12, but, he's definitely, I think, just the happiest moments. And I think that's the great thing about sports is that, you never know when somebody is just going to take you for a ride. And by 1987, he really started to take on superhero qualities. He was a guy that he just, even down six with 10 seconds left, you just felt like, well, Larry's going to figure this out. It was like John Wayne. And I've never, ever rooted for anybody like that before or since. But I'm sure, you know, Chicago fans are probably listening to that thinking they felt the same way about Jordan. I bet Laker fans feel the same way about Magic, and so on and so on. There's certain athletes that just pass through your life that have an impact like that.
It's probably going against your form to ask you for a short answer to a question, but what the heck? What's your prediction for the finals this time around?
Initially, it was San Antonio versus Boston, and then I switched it after seeing an Orlando preseason game and thought San Antonio-Orlando. And now after watching the Celtics again, I do think it's going to be San Antonio-Boston. My goal is to just make as many predictions as possible, and then one of them will be right. And I can say, I picked that. I try to make 10.
Just make sure somebody saves the tape of the one you got right.
Yeah, I think that's a good strategy. Maybe we should record 5 different predictions, and then you could just run that one.
Bill Simmons, a.k.a. The Sports Guy, is the author of The Book of Basketball, published by ESPN Books. He joined me from KQED in San Francisco. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. It was great.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. And we had help this week from Steele Muller at KQED in San Francisco and from Brian Gaynor at the Sheboygan Press. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from ESPN's Bill Simmons, who characterizes the Cleveland Cavaliers' set offense.
You watch the Cavs now. I don't even know if they run plays. They just tell people, you stand over there and LeBron's going to try to score. You know, it's like Teen Wolf.
Okay, so does that mean if LeBron James is Scott Howard, then Zydrunas Ilgauskas is Boof? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.